Every once in a while, gun culture goes through a great witch hunt to weed out people who are participating in stolen valor. And stolen valor, in its simplest definition, is what happens when a person claims some sort of position or to have done something in a military action that they didn't do. They lie about their history, they lie about their profession or their job or what unit they were a part of. And you see these cases come out in two most distinct forms, which we'll get into in a minute. And stolen valor, though, when every once in a while there is a case that happens where that is so spectacular that it sets a fervor amongst the community to root out and find other possible examples of stolen valor. When a person claims to be an ex-cool guy, and it turns out that not only were they never admitted to the unit, but they were rejected in shame and barely had any military experience at all, this is one of these cases. And there's the types of stories that people tell, or the stories that they tell publicly about themselves, oftentimes exist in an inverse proportionality to their actual achievements. And while this isn't an absolute law, it's something we might call a heuristic, a rule of thumb of sorts. But there is another heuristic that we see that when it comes to the evaluation of others' capabilities of violence, and that this heuristic, this inverse proportionality, comes with disastrous consequences for those who intentionally blind themselves to their participation in it. And so after we toss it over to the sponsor, we are going to talk about two different inverse proportionalities that are, though prevalent in gun culture, not unique to it itself. And so the first sponsor, let's get into this. The first sponsor of the Redacted Culture Cast has been and is Obsidian Arms. Obsidian Arms is a machine shop and a fabrication factory, if you want to call it. It's a machine shop out of Minnesota that sells armorer's tools, some of which are AR-15 specific, and some of them are much more general use for both professional and budding gunsmiths in our age of modularity, that come with a lifetime warranty. And so if you're building out a garage or you're looking for specific tools that you might want to keep in a field kit, I'd ask you or suggest to check out Obsidian Arms. They also provide OEM services for those in the industry or who are looking to make their way in that have a product that they have designed or in the process of designing, and Obsidian Arms can help you take that idea and bring it to life. They use U.S.-sourced materials in their machining, and they are capable of more than just a CNC machine. So, if you have a product that you are bringing to market or you are looking for armorer's tools, go check out Obsidian Arms at obsidianarms.com. So, an inverse proportionality is a case, and I'm going to use a web definition, as dangerous as that is. An inverse proportionality is when the value of one quantity increases with respect to the decrease in another, or vice versa. In other words, the more you have of one, the less you have of another. And when it comes to these types of more stolen valor-esque stories, the heuristic is thus: the bigger and more about the individual that the story is, and the more publicly it's proclaimed to declare, in a sense, virtue signal, that not only the less likely it that the story is true, but it also might reveal skeletons in the closet. And so there's a way that this tends to play out in people, and I think there's an explanation. And if you find yourself in this trap, I'm not saying go seek help. I'm suggesting watch out, it might hurt you. And so very oftentimes we find cases where an individual has sold their public identity as being something like a Ranger or a Navy SEAL or a Delta Force guy or the person who killed Osama bin Laden or Saddam Hussein. And while this is not an absolute truth, what we tend to find is that those who build their entire public persona on being an ex-cool guy, oftentimes, once the investigation is done, we find out that not only were they not there or did not do the things that they do, but rather they may be compensating for a feeling that they didn't achieve something that they could have or should have achieved during that time. There's this sense of guilt or regret for achievements not completed that are compensated with a lie. While the military itself is pretty thorough with its records of people's placement in various units, and these things can be researched and they can be found out, with as thorough as that is, one would wonder why somebody who was in the military would lie about their military achievements or their military history. So much of this is so readily available, is at least researchable, that you would think that a person would be averse to lying about what they did or who they were or what unit they were in. And what you oftentimes see, even from people who haven't joined the military, is a similar activity. This is the most caricaturistically caricatured in the, well, I would have joined the military, but I would have fought my drill instructor type language. And we see this in gun culture where, and I have been guilty of this, where the more a person bases their identity on something, the more suspicious that claim tends to be. This is how, and we've seen gun culture evolve so cleanly through this, as we're moving away from a lot of that hero worship that was very present in the early 2000s and even the teens, some of which very likely influenced my choice to do what I did. And yet, as gun culture is maturing and in a sense not decentralizing or broadening, but moving away from these sort of peaks and pillars around personalities and more to communities and families and neighborhoods and participation and mutual involvement, the more it seems to be moving in that way, the more we are seeing the fruitlessness of claiming to be something formerly cool. And so the inverse relationship with these big fish stories tends to be that the bigger the story, the more suspicion might be warranted. The bigger the story, the less likely it is true. But also, there's another way to approach this heuristic, and it can be looked at in our own lives as well, and that is that the more that the story hinges on the identity of the speaker, the less valuable it is to the community because it is more about building up that person's identity. And before this turns into a macro ad hominem combination with the argument from authority, it isn't so much that people's experience doesn't contribute to the gun culture and doesn't contribute to our corpus of knowledge and available information on the subject. It's that if you go to a course and all you find out and all you learn is all the cool things your instructor once did, he's not really teaching you something. Right? And so this might be something that a instructor can reflect upon as they are refining their craft, is to not necessarily avoid any references to experience or past experience or places that they've been, but be wary that they may be robbing their students of valuable time trained or valuable training time by trying to validate their own person. There's a difference between validating my identity, as we've talked about before, with different elements of sort of like the queer thing with identity without an essence, but most specifically within gun culture, is that as we're communicating to one another about the things that we know or we are trying to add value to, it's important to reflect and take on the mindset of an instructor or what you think an instructor should be. And that a teacher or an instructor's goal is not to build their selves up really, but to maybe through some of their experiences instill confidence and capability in the students. And for a side note, and this is something that this a side note that has to do with teaching, is that when people are learning to shoot, say, a firearm, and especially in the early stages, you very oftentimes see that the student is completely focused on hitting the target. They are completely consumed by the goal of hitting their target, of being accurate. Where the instructor's role, and I think the instructor's role early on in teaching, is to instill confidence in the student that they know what the firearm is going to do when they use it. They know what the safety does and the magazine release does, and they know how to rack the slide and check if it's empty and check the trigger and you well not check the trigger but pull the trigger, and they know these kinds of things. This is where dry fire is immensely important. But then if you start with that confidence and that base, you start with that base, that foundation, you can always add and increase accuracy as you go on. And so when we have opportunities to teach, it's important to remember what the goal of the instructor ought to be. And if we find ourselves going too long, perhaps arguing with ghosts, arguing with people who are not even in the room, other instructors or former military members that we've trained with, or a team leader or a sergeant major or something, where we're, and what I mean by arguing with ghosts is that the instructor's conversation, their teaching point appears to be more focused on resolving an argument that wasn't that was started long before the course even began, and less about developing that skill set in the student. That's something to check. And so check that part of what we would say maybe ego. Although I don't think it's purely ego. I think there is some I do believe that there is a genuine concern, and this is the way that people are trying to convey this information. So there's a second inverse proportionality that is both inside and outside of gun culture, and that is that those who are the most capable of violence are the least likely to telegraph it. And I'm using telegraph from the language that people use around video games, where you're fighting a boss, and the boss does a certain move before he does another certain move, and the first move is the cue to dodge out of the way. An example of telegraphing in a video game is the boss lifts his sword, so roll out of the way so that when he swings his sword, you're not standing there. And but telegraphing in this macro scale, especially within gun culture, and even more reflected outside of it, is that the more capable an individual is at use of force, the less likely they're going to threaten somebody. The most likely cases, the most common cases of people, or the where you find people who make a lot of threats, they very oftentimes are not capable. They're not well trained or well capable of the use of force. You'd think of it in a simple sense in the story of like somebody learning how to do jujitsu. You might think you're a great fighter until you get humbled a couple times. But there's another part to it, and I think there's this second part that's more nefarious and self-destructive. And I have to get to that. The way to get there is to go in this conversation is to start here. So we see this inverse proportionality in our culture, that those who are the most capable of force tend not to make threats. And they tend not, and for various reasons, it's all down to the individual. And you see this represented in perhaps one of the greatest arguments against gun control, is that the most armed, most capable, and most trained individuals in the country are not the people who are shooting up schools. Rather, when you see these public outbursts of violence, oftentimes with some sort of manifesto or or in these very public cases, you don't you, the identity of the individual reveals that they're not well trained, they're not skilled, they're not well connected. And so this is something that we're very thankful for. And this should also instill a little bit of confidence. I hope this instills some confidence if you're part of a church security team or if you're part of a training cadre, is it's not to make you arrogant, but those who are threatening violence, especially publicly, and are yet not somehow being punished for it, say censored on social media, are very rarely the people who are the most skilled in the use of force. Now, note, I am not saying that they're not the most dangerous. Rather, they present a much more dangerous issue than mere skill. And what happens, and what happens in this case, and what we see in this, it's not a law, this heuristic, this commonality, is that people who do not believe that they are capable of force, or they do not, inside they feel like they are maybe not necessarily weak, but they view themselves in the sense of being the victim or the lesser. When they do lash out, they tend to lash out very recklessly. You could think, you know, you could have two guys in a boxing fight, and one of them is well trained and one of them is completely unskilled. The one who is unskilled is going to flail about, possibly risking injury, no less than somebody who is skilled, but that injury is going to be uncalculated. And so you think, we see this with people in possession of firearms, in the sense that a person who is not trained or has not built that skill, when they find themselves in a position where they believe that they're justified in the use of force, very oftentimes spray and pray in this sense. We saw this often. I've seen this in Afghanistan. I've seen this around the world, in that the sense of that sense of skill and understanding restrains the individual to use force more appropriately. Now, why is this so dangerous, and why is it so dangerous in ourselves? Well, if we believe that we ourselves could never do that, we could never use force or never shoot somebody or never do anything evil, we do not build within ourselves the discipline to prevent ourselves from doing that evil. You see this inverse proportionality in the types of people who go along with great massacres, is that they believe themselves to be helpless or the victims, or they believe that they are some sort of morally justified and somehow by identity justified to use force. Because the bully is strong, the weak kid who's getting bullied is justified to use any force he can to fight back against the bully. And the problem in this scenario and that mentality is that it is not necessarily a circular argument, but it is a self-justifying idea. And that the core argument, the core foundation, is not in the logic, not in a logic-based or logic-grounded argument on the justified use of force, but it's functionally grounded in the identity of the individual. You see, so if a person identifies as being a kid being bullied, they are justifying the use of force on their identity, not on the injustice that might be being done, but rather on themselves. And there's no less ego in the bully than there is in the bullied, in this case, in this kind of scenario. Now, there are certainly people who just do evil for the sake of evil. There are people who look at what is good, disdain that which is good, and then act on the evil because they know it, knowing that it is evil, and desiring to see the evil come out, or desiring to see themselves as participating in the evil. And this is a very uncomfortable topic to, let's say, contemplate, because we have to recognize that no, not every case of evil can be simply dismissed into a difference in perspective. So these two inverse proportionalities that we're talking about. The first one being the big fish story, the overly blemished cool guy story. Some people will embellish their stories for humor or to turn it into a story, that and the purpose of the story is to entertain people. But if you're telling stories and they're constantly dependent on developing your identity as something, that should be a warning sign. And if we are interacting with people who are whose primary contribution to, say, the community is something that they once were, then that person needs friends, and they need help. It's too crass, it's too sharp. And the other thing that we see is that when it is another thing that we should see is that people who are very boisterous about their capabilities are oftentimes revealing, and don't get me wrong, people make mistakes, but this is very oftentimes revealing, or could be seen as justification or revealing, that not only are they not the thing that they said they were, but that they're hinging on skill they don't have, they're hinging on skill that they don't have. It doesn't mean that they're any less dangerous, however. In fact, I think that they might be, in a sense, more dangerous. And they might be more dangerous because the type of force, the way that they're going to use force, is more likely to be vengeful, malicious, and indiscriminate. And so, in that case, as we are observing the world around us, as we are navigating our communities, as we are developing relationships and building up our own culture amongst us, it is important to be wary of the big fish story and the loud, threatening language. And I wanted to present this in a way that wasn't just people lie and they talk smack online. It's counterproductive if you're trying to enter into the industry in the long run, or you're trying to enter into the gun culture, you're a part of this culture, it's counterproductive in the long run to lie. We know this sort of intuitively, but we don't act on it all the time. Or maybe I'm just confessing right now. However, the important element, and I think something that motivates and inspires the moral choice that gun culture participates in, is that they see the recklessness in the world. They recognize that they could be like that. They don't want to be like that. And so they train so that if they are using force, they will use it morally and proportionally. This being the case, and this being the way, or this being what I am arguing, what I am presenting to you, this being my perception, and in the sense my argument, then also can be used for introspection. And that is, if you think that you are helpless, be wary. You might be setting yourself up to follow in the footsteps of those who have done great evil in the past. So even if this is a bit more of an abstract episode for the Redacted Culture Cast, if this episode was productive or you have something to add to it and you're watching on YouTube, please leave a comment below. I'd love to interact more with you guys. And if you want to do so in a more private setting and have more over that opportunity, you can go over to redactedculture.locals.com. And finally, this episode is being published while we have a pre-order open. And that pre-order includes a list. It's a t-shirt. So it worked. I think I like the design, and I want to see if you are interested, because I don't know how much I can technically promote it on the internet. But if we are going to go forward in this world and we want to choose to do so morally, then it is imperative for us to consider these things. And I hope that I have added a tool to your intellectual toolbox, whether you are in gun culture or outside of it. If I have, share it if you can. Share this episode with your friends. See see what they think, see what we can do to make our community better. And if nothing else, go forth and conquer.